You're listening to Scarves Around the Funnel, brought to you in association with Forest Hepburn and McDonald's Signs.
Getting noticed isn't always easy, because there's so much noise.
But at Forest Hepburn and McDonald's, we make it easy. With standout signs, business cards, shop fronts, banners, leaflets, vehicle graphics, the lot. Showcasing your products, advertising your brand, and getting business noticed. So, what can we do for you? Forest Hepburn and McDonald's, creative sign and print solutions since the 1950s. Visit fhmcdsigns.co.uk.
Kingsley rolls to the boys. Back to Kingsley. Curls it twice. Lovely effort.
2-0!
No! Kingsley magic!
Hello and welcome to Scarves Around the Funnel, the podcast dedicated to Heart of Midlothian Football Club, who reminded us that it's not always rosy after a game. We've had a good run of it, but Hearts did lose at the weekend to Ross County. And just like that, Mark Donaldson's throwing the towel. He's not even going to join us this week. He is, in fact, enjoying some time with the latest Tampa Rowdies head coach, Robbie Nielsen.
It's a hell of a name.
It is, yes. And look at that. Mark Donaldson does not appear, and we're joined by Ryan McGowan, who came on just so we could get an official apology from all of us on behalf of Heart of Midlothian for getting beaten by Ross County and closing the gap to St Johnstone to 1 point.
Yes, it was not the result that I was looking for at the weekend, if I'm being brutally honest with you guys. So a little bit disappointed in all of yous. Disappointed in Mark for not coming on. But also, it is good that he's out with his mate Roberto.
We won't talk about it. I think they started their first game of the season well. They were 2-0 up, but they lost that 2-0 lead. So still some work for Robbie to do in Tampa, but hopefully things kick on for him over there. Although I'm not really keen on the kits. Was it a kind of green and yellow sort of number going on? Anyway, well, Mark couldn't make it. Ryan, we're delighted to say, has made it. And we're also joined by Scott McIntosh, who will help us dissect that defeat of the weekend. How are you doing, Scott? Were you shoegazing all the way home from Dingwall on Saturday?
Oh, I wasn't up at the game, thankfully. I managed to stream the match from mainland Europe, so I got to suffer just like everyone else, unfortunately, even although I wasn't quite there in body.
Okay, I'll let you off. I am Laurie Dunsire, delighted to be joined by Ryan and Scott. We are going to be joined by a special guest shortly as well. Mixing things up a bit, it's international weekend coming up, so we've not got a Hearts game to preview, and we don't want to talk about Ross County Hearts too much. So we are going to be joined by Ailey Doyle, who is, of course, a very well-known Hearts fan and a very successful track and field athlete. So similar to us having Lee McGregor on early in the season, we're going to go in a bit of a different route. We'll talk about her time supporting Hearts and how she got into supporting Hearts as well, but also her time as an athlete and maybe some tips from her on how Ryan McGowan will tackle potential retirement as that starts to loom quickly. But he's got a Sky Sports gig these days, so you'll be fine.
Hey, come on now.
You're listening to Scarves Around the Funnel, sponsored by Forest Hepburn and McDonald's Signs, who have been offering creative sign and print solutions since the 1950s. Let's start with Heart of Midlothian away to Ross County at the weekend. Hearts going into the game unbeaten in 14 matches against Ross County, 11 unbeaten in Dingwall. In fact, their only ever league defeat at that ground was over 10 years ago. And in terms of recent form, Hearts just one defeat in 16, and Ross County just one win in 15. Hearts going into this game with a 4-3-3 shape, really, on the face of it, that would gradually change as the game goes on. We'll get into that, but starting with Xander Clark in goals, Atkinson right, Kingsley left, Sibbick and Rolls in the centre, Benny Beningame, Aidan Denham and Alex Cochrane in midfield. Aidan Denham, though, the one pushing forward quite a bit from there, with Vargas and Forrest flanking Shankland in attack. Now, this game, Scott, it felt very early on like the sort of games where Hearts have not been successful. And thankfully, this season under Stephen Naismith, that's been the minority overall in terms of being successful within matches and getting results. But Ross County were very happy for Hearts to have the ball in this game. They only took about a third of possession overall, Ross County. But it didn't feel like, with that setup, with the players we had out there, that it was working from us, especially kind of transitioning from the back, did it? And Ross County were looking at like they might be able to impact us when they were trying to hit on the counter and go quite direct.
Yeah, I think there's a mixture of two things at play. I mentioned after the last Hibs game that one of the concerns about the gap that we've managed to build for ourselves over the chasing pack for that third, fourth spot was that you could enter the business end of the season playing against teams who just have that bigger will to win. And it's quite clear just very clear in the minds of the other teams that they need to win a game of football. So against Hibs knew that every game between them and the split's pretty much a cup final to get in the top six. You're playing Ross County, it's very clear to them what they need to do to sort of stay up as well. And I think that's a bit of an issue that we're going to face over the next few weeks as well. So it's something that the club are going to have to try and address, because it was fairly obvious as the game wore on, particularly from about 20 minutes onwards, that Ross County looked a bit more up for it. I mean, to tie in with that, I felt that we started the game, which seems to be a trend this season, we were very passive. We tend to be quite methodical with the ball in possession, which I understand the argument of if we've got the ball, they can't score. I really do understand that argument. But unfortunately, teams have now identified the fact that we don't have a lot of creativity and guile in the middle of the park, and therefore they're quite happy for us to have possession until we maybe get into that final third, and then they'll start to maybe press from a low block situation. So it's quite frustrating. You mentioned Denham starting, the more advanced of the midfield three during the week, and it looks as if Aidan Denham and Cammy Devlin have been identified as two players that Stephen Naismith is wanting to try and sort of transition into playing number 10 positions for the club. And it's been tried on a number of occasions now for both players, and I've yet to see any evidence that it works for either of them. Now, in particular fixtures, I think if you look at Celtic away, when Aidan Denham was playing sort of higher up there, and Cammy Devlin and sort of seasons gone past as well, they can certainly play a sort of advanced 10 position if we've got less of the ball and they're sort of triggering the press from an advanced point of view. But I think when you've got 65-70% possession against a team like Ross County, they don't strike me as the types of individuals that are adept at finding pockets of space. And I get it. Naismith's obviously trying to get the most out of his squad. He's trying to get a bit of versatility out of some of his midfield players. It's clearly a position that he thinks we need to plug, hence why we've looked at Jan Danda on that pre-contract. But yeah, for me, that's not working just now. And if it's not working, you've got to try and find another way, whether that's being a bit more direct. It's something that they maybe have to consider over the next few weeks.
Scott mentions Jan Danda. He was someone who came into the starting 11 for this game, and I thought he did add a little bit of a quality in Ross County. Maybe they've got a lot of endeavour that Don Cowie certainly instilled in them. They certainly seem to be working as a team, but maybe sometimes lacking that bit of quality. Not so much in this game. Ryan, you've played against Jan Danda this season, I think three times now. He was having his name sung from the Hearts end, which was an interesting occurrence. Obviously, nothing is confirmed about his agreement to join Hearts, although we expect it to be a done deal, pretty much, touch wood. What have you made of him when you've come up against him? Have you seen him? What are kind of his attributes?
I think Scott just mentioned it. It's that ability to be able to take the ball in situations and create something. And that's what Hearts have been missing, a lot this season, is somebody that's comfortable in the final third to take the ball and have that ownership of, I'm going to go create something, whether that be a goal, whether that be an opportunity, And you know, if he's in the current Hearts team, he would be playing that role instead of Cammy and Aiden Denham. So, you know, I feel like from one side, if he does sign, well, it looks like he will do, it's a good bit of business from the management and the board, I guess, of, you know, targeting a player from the league that knows the league that would benefit Hearts for the way that they play, because, you know, like Scott said, they are putting a big onus on being a possession-based team. And if you are going to have that and have, you know, 50-60% of the possession, then you need players that can unlock a low block or unlock a team that is down there and quite comfortable in sitting in that low block. And, you know, at St. Johnstone, we do that a fair bit. You know, we're sort of a low block sometimes in, you know, set situations, whether that be a goal kick or, you know, situations where we can be a little bit more advanced. But, you know, the rule of thumb is we're probably sitting a low block like most teams kind of do. And, you know, kind of say it basically up to Hearts or anyone that's playing us, come break us down. And you need those players like Dander to come in and be able to do that. And I think it would be a really good signing if he does sign.
It was a brilliant Dander pass, actually, that did unlock the Hearts defence, unfortunately, to set Simon Murray through for the opener late in the half, denied by Xander Clark in the first instance, but managed to stab home the rebound. This is a frustrating one, isn't it, Scott? Because we've bigged Toby Sivic up a few times in this podcast, and I am a fan of him in many ways, but this game was maybe one of those where you can see why there are still doubters about Toby Sivic and why he is basically a squad player at the moment for Hearts and he isn't a regular starter, because for him and for Kai Rowles, this just was an afternoon to forget.
Yeah, I mean, look, everything that we've said about Toby over the last few months to a year, I think it still stands true. I still think he has a lot that he can offer as a maybe a right centre half and a three. We've mentioned this before, and obviously at the tail end of last season, a mixture of injury and suspension, we really had no option but to sort of play Kai Rowles and Toby Sivic as a central pairing in a back four, and it didn't really work out. I think both of them, for all the good they bring, they lack a little bit of the aggressiveness and leadership that the likes of sort of Halkett and Kent can bring. So I think as soon as you saw they were starting in a four, you were a little bit worried. I felt Rowles in particular was rattled by Murray on a couple of occasions first 10 minutes. And then Stephen Naismith did eventually make the change later on in the first half. But I think what's most frustrating about the opening goal is that for me, it was an indication of a football player not learning from past mistakes. It had similar hallmarks to the goal that we conceded to Hibs in the semi-final a couple of years ago, where Toby's sort of, you know, trying to shield the ball out. He's really not getting his body in the right position, sort of separating the opposition player from the ball, and the ball gets nicked off him and Hibs score, you know, and it gives Hibs a fresh impetus in that game. So it does concern me when I see players who are, you know, I know relatively speaking, Toby's still a young player, but I think he's at a stage now where he should be learning for those types of mistakes, and that is a bit of an issue, unfortunately.
So Hearts went into the break 1-0 behind. Now, they had switched things around in the first half. I don't know what you made of this, Scott. We had a bit of a debate about it at half-time, because to me, and to Rob as well, when we were watching it, it kind of just looked like they'd swapped Rowles and Kingsley around, and Kingsley gone central and Rowles had gone left. To us, it didn't look like it was an obvious sort of change to a 3-5-2. In the second half, it certainly was. I don't know what you made of it at the time. It seemed very lopsided, at very least. We were struggling to kind of see the shape properly kind of working.
I think they did switch it to the 3-5-2 earlier on. I just think it didn't become as apparent as it did in the second half. Possibly just due to instructions being given to Alan Forrest. I don't know. They maybe felt that they could go with a slightly lopsided formation and have Alan Forrest still supporting in a more advanced role. I don't know. But it did become more apparent in the second half that that's the formation they'd went with. But I do think the change had been made in the first half.
change certainly evident in the second half. Didn't help things, though. 4 minutes into the second period, County go 2-0 up, throw in midway inside the Hearts half on the right, played into Danda, pretty simple layoff to Reid, who's overlapping. He cuts it across goals, a little flick from Brophy and an emphatic finish from Simon Murray. Hearts bring on Dixie Olympiakos and George Grant 8 minutes later. They try and mix things up. A few moments to talk about. 63rd minute, Lawrence Shanklin is challenged in the box. I don't know if you've had a chance to see this one back, Ryan.
I have.
So this is Ryan Leake's making the challenge. Now, Hearts have appealed this yellow card for Lawrence Shanklin. Now, it's an interesting one because, you know, first we're claiming for a penalty. It didn't look like there was maybe enough in it for a penalty. I'm not 100% sure on that, but there isn't really a, it doesn't look like a dive, and there's not really a claim from Shanklin either, is there? I don't know how you feel about this one as a defender looking at that.
I think you can tell by the reaction. I honestly don't think that he was appealing for a penalty, and I also don't think it's a penalty, and I also don't think it's a foul, but there definitely is contact, if any of that makes sense. I think it's just one of those challenges that kind of happens everywhere. I don't think he's dived. I do think there was contact, but I don't think the yellow card is necessary. You see players like actually dive all the time and not get away with it as such, but you know, it's not a yellow, but it's not a penalty, so play on type thing.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why that wasn't kind of what the ref kind of went for, I guess.
I think it's one of, and I've mentioned it's a frustration of mine before, that sometimes you get penalties given and everyone focuses on there was contact, slow it down, you see there was contact, and it's like, well, there could be contact and it not be a penalty. And again, if someone goes down in the box, it's almost, I don't know if you feel like this, Scott, sometimes I feel like people try and make it too black and white. Contact equals penalty, no contact equals dive. And it's not always as simple as that. Sometimes it's just two players come together, it's not fouling, and that's it.
Yeah, I think, you know, referees get such a hard time, and sometimes it's, you know, it's I think it's wrong. I think, you know, we've mentioned this before after the Celtic game, I think we've got a tendency to want referees to referee the game the way that we either played in or watched when we were younger, but they've got to go by the letter of the law. Whereas I think this is an example where pundits could probably say, well, you know what, this probably shows a lack of game knowledge from a referee. Everything is pretty black and white to them in this scenario, versus Ryan's perfectly summed it up. It's probably not a penalty. There's minor contact, but it's not a dive either. So it's just it's just a case of waving the game on, and there's no need to sort of reprimand Shanklin for it.
10 minutes later, the next big talking point, and this one certainly divided a few people. 73rd minute, free kick edge of the box, Hearts trying to get a goal back. Stephen Kingsley lines it up, curls a wonderful finish in for the second of the season. We're all celebrating, Hearts back in it, still got probably more than 20 minutes, including added time, to try and turn it around. And then we get the VAR check. And this is one where I've completely changed from my initial opinion. I didn't see the angle from behind the goal at first. So at first I was like, how can there be a VAR check? It's a free kick over the wall into the back of the net. What possibly could they be checking here? And then they mentioned there was a player in the keeper's sight line and he was obstructing his view. And again, that seemed ludicrous to me. And then I saw the angle from behind the goal, and that's when I was like, okay, I see it. So obviously those listening will have no doubt seen it. Lawrence Shanklin is standing offside, clearly offside, and he is in front of goalkeeper. And he does move away just as Kingsley kicks the ball, and it flies into the corner of the net. Now, I've seen mixed opinions on this one. My opinion now is that is the right decision. It's frustrating because I do not think the goalkeeper is going to save it. I think that's going into the back of the net regardless. And I guess my biggest frustration is, does Shanklin need to be there and do that? But I think from a Hearts point of view, you know, Ryan, the thing that I thought of afterwards, if that's Xander Clarke or that's Craig Gordon, and they're having to peer around the opposition striker. They are doing the exact same thing as the County players. They're screaming at the referee.
I don't know. I think it should be a goal. I'm not saying that because...
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's one of those ones. It's a set-free kick, so are you trying to tell me that the keeper's saying... Like, did the keeper appeal for it? I didn't actually see if he was appealing for it.
He did. He did. So as soon as it goes in, he appeals, and I think it's it's like what a lot of footballers do, appeal for anything you can.
Yeah.
I think he knows why well he's not saving it either way, but I think for me, I think what I said on Twitter is you're giving the referee a decision to make. I don't like that decision because I don't think Shankland has impacted the keeper ability to save the ball because it's such a good free kick, but that doesn't mean he wasn't obstructing his line of vision. And I think that's what does it say in the rules. It says he's offside if a player's interfering with an opponent, and I think it says preventing an opponent from playing or being able to play the ball by clearly obstructing the opponent's line of vision. Was he going to save it either way? No, but did Shankland obstruct his view and his ability to play the ball? You can argue that.
Oh, yeah, but you could argue everything.
I know. I'm interested to see where Scott comes in on this. I think I know where he is because I'm trying to remember our conversation afterwards, and I think Scott did side with me. I don't like to sit here and argue that I actually think the referee rightly disallowed a very good free kick from Stephen Kingsley, but I don't think Shanklin needs to be there, and he knows what he's doing, doesn't he? Because you can see him, he glances around at the goalkeeper. He glances around at least once over his shoulder, and he moves away just as Kingsley sends the free kick in.
Yeah, I mean, all I can say about the incident is, if there's not an issue with it, he wouldn't even move. So he knows himself. He knows himself that there's a potential there for that to be deemed offside if he doesn't move quick enough, and he doesn't. He's a half second off. So to me, that says it all. Look, in terms of VAR getting involved in it, and again, it taking time, and it sort of, you know, quashing the atmosphere and diluting the joy scoring goals, I get that side of the argument. But in terms of the, again, letter of the law, it's pretty cut and dry offside for me.
Can't believe it's a St Johnstone player on this that's arguing the case for the Hearts goal. I want to be arguing the case for the Hearts goal.
I just think it's all getting silly now, isn't it?
I agree, but I just think if you're going to look at the decision, you've given the referee a reason to be able to disallow it, and you look at the way a rule is written.
I get
for me, why
saying.
Is the linesman not flagging? Like, the linesman should have a good view of that. Like, you shouldn't even need VAR, really, in that decision.
I suppose the only defence I would say is from the linesman angle. Can he tell exactly where Shanklin is in terms of the goalkeeper's line of sight? I suppose that would be the only thing from the far side of the field.
And again, just thinking now, like a lot of referees, I'll just
wait and see if and that doesn't matter.
And that is an issue. That is an issue, unfortunately.
So it didn't count, unfortunately. It was a well hit free kick, unfortunately. I feel for Stephen Kingsley because I think it was going to go in regardless. Didn't count. Took the wind out of Hearts' sails a little bit. They did bring on Yutaro Oda for the final 8 minutes plus stoppages, and he scored a fine goal, which was good to see on his return. And overall, Scott, is this just one of these games that maybe, well, they came at a good time, but we've got the break for the internationals coming up. We said it as well, you said it mainly, other teams have more to fight for Hearts. Is it something maybe that's at a good time for us? Like, here's a little wake up. We've still got a good bit of the season left. We've still got a trip to Hampden coming up. We need to kind of get back on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think most players normally like to try and sort of bounce back immediately once they've lost a game of football. And I think from that point of view, it's possibly a little bit disappointing that we don't have the game at the weekend. But there's a number of players that are going away on international duty. Hopefully, they'll get a bit of a boost of confidence when they come back from that. We'll have certain players a bit closer to getting back as well. I don't know if there's a bit of a sort of outside chance of the likes of Kent and Neuenhoff being involved in the Killy game, which will clearly help us as well. So, look, the one thing I would say about the current Hearts team is that given the form that we've had since the start of December, one result like this can only be described as a blip just now. It's over the coming weeks whether it becomes something more substantial and something to worry about. But I do think there's there's trends, again, there's patterns of play, and there's things that happened on Saturday that we've seen in games throughout the season, regardless of whether we've won or lost. And I do think that there's some worrying issues again with the midfield. That is, like, as much as I'm concerned about the right back area, I'm equally concerned about our midfield area just now moving into the summer. And I'm just hopeful that it's just a work in progress just now, and it's something that eventually, you know, we'll see some results from all the work that Stephen Naismith's obviously trying to do Monday to Friday.
Yeah, I think you mentioned before we came on record, so how many changes is it you mentioned that we've seen?
Yeah, I had a little look, because sometimes, especially with recency bias, you'll maybe just think back to the last couple of games and you're like, why do I feel like the team are making a lot of changes at half time? Is that just been a short-term thing, or has that actually been happening throughout the season? So I decided to have a little look back from the first game onwards, and in 14 individual matches, we've actually made personnel changes at half-time. So I'm not even counting sort of system and formation changes, but in terms of personnel changes, we've made 19 changes in 14 games, and predominantly a lot of those changes have come from the midfield area. So it's clear that Stephen Naismith is not happy with the results of what he's trying to work on week to week, but it has been quite a long-running thing now. This isn't something that's just happened over a 2 or 3 week period. This is stretching back to August of last year. Now, I think what we've got to add to that, and I think we've been quite good at saying this previously, he's shown a lot of adaptability and sort of flexibility to make changes, and he hasn't been weighed down by his own ego to go, well, you know what, I'll give it another 15, 20 minutes to see if my original team selection works. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, but you do need to address the fact that we are having to make a number of changes at half-time, and I would, without looking back to historical information, that seems quite excessive, that number of changes in one season.
Well, hopefully we'll see an improvement in that area. Certainly, it's not a game we're going to get too down about. Maybe not as down as Ryan would, but but maybe a little wake up for Hearts. We've still got some matches to play. A bit of improvement needed for the home game against Kilmarnock coming up after the international break. This week on Scarves Around the Funnel, we are delighted to be joined by a very special guest, Scotland's most decorated track and field athlete, an Olympic medal winner, a European champion, 3-time Commonwealth silver medalist, 7-time British champion, 4-time Scottish national champion, and of course, very passionate Jambo. It's Ailey Doyle. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to being part of this.
No, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on. We're diversifying a little bit. It's international break. We don't want to talk about Ross County Hearts too much. So we had Lee McGregor on early in the season, so we had a boxing angle there. So a bit more track and field. So we're going to talk about Hearts, but for me and maybe other listeners, who I won't lie, it's not a kind of sport that I've fallen off a lot. Maybe it'll be educational as well. So hopefully we'll get a bit of everything. And it's good to have someone on who was a proper athlete as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I knew that was coming.
First off, how are things with you now? Because you've been retired for almost 3 years at this point, is it?
Yeah, technically I retired in 2021, sort of June 2021. But actually my last official race was 2019, March 2019. I did that indoor season and finished up at the European Champs in Glasgow. And then I took the 2019 summer season off to have my first child, and then planned to come back for the Tokyo Olympics. Obviously, COVID kicked in, everything got postponed. And ultimately, my plan was to come back for Tokyo, then retire, make my third Olympics and retire off the back of that. But just with having my wee boy and everything that happened with COVID and the restrictions that was always going on, I just kind of thought, oh, you know what, I think I'm just ready to sort of stop now and kind of leave it with the memories pre-COVID and the good times that I had, rather than trying to sort of get back and not necessarily be in the best shape I would have been probably beforehand, and yeah, go to Tokyo in a very different sort of atmosphere and planning that it wasn't sort of before COVID. So yeah, so although I retired in 2021, technically I hadn't actually raced since 2019. So it's been a long, it was a long transition, a long retirement sort of out of the sport.
How have you found that so far? Because it must be a bit odd in some ways, because you know, I guess some people think retirement means that you're having a break, but you had Campbell January 2020, so you're just before COVID, as you mentioned. You've had a second since then. So has retirement been a bigger challenge than when you were racing?
Yeah, well, the trouble is with retiring at what, 34 I was when I retired officially. You know, as you retire as an athlete, you need to then get another job, and then get another job as a 34-year-old is strange, and it's quite daunting as well. And then having obviously the two young boys as well. So it's been a real, it's been a strange couple of years, kind of exploring, you know, doing different bits here and there and trying to work out what I want to do, because, you know, for over a decade I was an athlete and that was very straightforward. You know, you had your races, you had your training, everything was really well structured, whereas now it's not. I mean, I love it. I think for me, it was, again, it was, you can't miss it too much because you're so distracted with family life. But yeah, it's been a different transition. It's a different sort of approach to life now that I would have had as an athlete. I kind of just wish I'd made more of the afternoon naps that you get as an athlete, you know, when I was training, and then you just come back, get a bit of physio, then, you know, have time to yourself. I didn't make the most of that, because I definitely don't get those opportunities now to have a wee nap in the afternoon.
Ryan, you're 34 yourself, contract up at the end of the season. Are you taking notes here?
I was taking notes. I was very much. Was that a scary process for you, or because of COVID kind of kicked in, was it a not an easier transition, but you'd kind of had a little bit of time off, whether you like that or not?
Yeah, I actually think I'm quite lucky in the sense that it was quite a long transition, because obviously I had the year out being pregnant. So I had that kind of year when I was almost sitting on the sidelines watching it, and that gave me a chance to see how much do I miss it by not being there. And then obviously when 2020 hit, nobody was competing, so we were all kind of in limbo, so mm-hmm. It was another year to kind of get my head around it too. And then when I sort of decided to retire, it was my choice. I kind of took it into my own hands, and I think I was really lucky in that sense that I could say, right, okay, that's it, I'm going to call it a day now. Whereas it wasn't like I was injured and I had to be forced out. It wasn't, you know, because I'd been cut from funding or financial situation that I had to stop. It was very much my choice to do it. And I think very few athletes get that choice to say, I'm done. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, I was still quite upset, you know, finally saying, well, that's it, I won't be doing that again. But I did feel quite relieved at the end of it as well, to be like, oh, that's it, you know, I'm done now. The decision's been made.
I want to chat about Supporting Hearts and getting into Supporting Hearts. You know, Scott, first off, how do you, what is your reason for Supporting Hearts? Where does it come from?
It's really just a straightforward family thing. From my dad's side, they were all Hearts fans. I grew up in Gorgie, first 5 years of my life as well. So I don't recall when someone told me there was two teams in Edinburgh. Knowing my dad, he probably waited till I was about maybe 10 or 11. But yeah, it was definitely just a bog standard, so just falling on for the family and getting taken to games and just being, you know, bitten by the bug due to that.
See, that's a nice typical Hearts fan story. Exactly what I was looking for what I was going to go into next, because Ailey, you were born in Perth. So you think maybe you could support a wee team like St Johnstone or something.
Yeah.
But your dad, Ronnie, is from Oban as well, I believe. So
yeah.
How did the Hearts link come about then? Because there's not the obvious route into it that the likes of Scott had.
No, it's a really strange one, actually. So yeah, my dad grew up in a little village called Connell, just next to Oban. So went to a primary school that had, no, not a lot of kids there. And basically, out of his group of friends, somebody supported Rangers, somebody supported Celtic, and somebody supported Hibs. So he wanted to be different, and he decided he would support Hearts, and just decided to follow Hearts from that point on. And then, you know, much like Scott, because you're, you know, my dad supported Hearts, he just kind of brought us all up. I'm one of four kids, and we were all just brought up supporting Hearts. And yeah, never really knew anything different than we were Heart supporters, and that's what we were. So yeah, it was down to my dad. But going back to actually being born in Perth, I remember the very first time I got asked to do a half-time draw. I'd just come back from the Commonwealth Games, and in Delhi and I won a silver medal, and Scott Wilson had asked me if I could do the halftime draw, and it was Hearts versus St Johnston. And he said in front of all the St Johnston fans, he's like, so you were born in Perth, why do you not support St Johnston? And that whole stadium booed me. So it was, I was knocked right back down to earth, you know, to, from the St Johnston fans. So yeah, it's something that I get asked quite a lot because I was born in Perth, but it's my dad's fault.
I'm sure Ryan's been booed a few times by the St Johnston fans as well.
Yep, been booed by both sets of fans a few times, which is a good experience to have.
What's your first memory of going to a Hearts game then? Do you remember the first time your dad took you along?
Yeah, I remember. I don't know if this was necessarily my first game, but it's my first memory. And I actually don't even know who it was against, but my older sisters and brother were swimming in a gala at the Commonwealth Pool, because we all did a lot of swimming as youngsters, and they had a gala that they were at. So my dad pretty much had me to look after for the day. So he was like, we'll go out for the day into Edinburgh. So we went to the Children's Museum on the Royal Mile, and then went out for some food, and then the afternoon part was going to football and watching Hearts play. And yeah, I just remember sitting in the stand just with him, and it was just, like I say, I don't really remember who we were playing. I know we won because my dad then called me sort of his lucky charm after that, but I just remember it being like this kind of almost like a wee bonding day with my dad, like the two of us, because like I say, I was one of four, so there wasn't a lot of sort of one-on-ones with mum and dad, so it was quite nice, just a day out just the two of us. And yeah, it finished with a victory at Tynecastle, so it was a nice memory.
I was going to say, Scott could probably work out what game it was if we had some clues, yeah. Maybe. He's probably got a video of it kicking about, yeah, somewhere.
He just needs a yellow card at a certain point and he'll know exactly when it was.
In terms of favourite memories then, was it a regular occurrence then your dad would take you along? Was there any big moments that stand out when you were going to watch Hearts?
Probably the biggest moments. I mean, we used to go fairly regularly, and then I think one of the sort of big memories was 1996 going to the cup final when we got hammered by Rangers. But I remember that was the first time I got my face painted, you know, going to a match, you know, big build up to it. And then obviously the devastation of getting, you know, hammered. But then 2 years later, we went to the cup final in 1998, obviously, when we won. And just the sheer contrast from that feeling after the 1996 final to then the 1998 final. And but just loads of really kind of funny memories from that one. Like they used to take I don't think they still got it, but they had like a Perth and Kinross supporters bus that would take us to all the matches. So I remember them taking us to the game, and it, obviously it was full of sort of, I was young at the time, but there was obviously quite a lot of drunk men on it. And I remember one guy was bursting for the toilet and there was no toilet on our bus, and we stopped at traffic lights. So we got off our supporters bus, got off and got onto another supporters bus that had a toilet, and then we lost him for the rest of the match. And then you just saw him at the end of the match, absolutely half with his, you know, scarf above his head singing. And it was just that kind of, you know, bonding that everybody gets when your team, you know, when your fans come together, but also when you win. And yeah, so probably 96 and 98, that big contrast between the two games is kind of that. That's when I really, you know, when you feel like you become a real fan, because you get that real, you know, devastating result, and then you get the glory moment as well, the victory.
Yeah, the highs and lows of being a Hearts fan. I think you, I think looking back at some previous interviews, you missed one of the big highs, which if Ryan's on, we always have to mention a certain game in 2012 as many times as possible. But I think at this point you're obviously a little bit older and your own career started, so when Hearts are putting five goals past Hibs, you were otherwise busy, weren't you?
Yeah, I was racing in Loughborough that weekend. My only claim to fame is I was in the programme, because I did an interview in the programme, and I actually predicted the scoreline. In fact, I said in Hearts 5-1 with Mark De Vries, and I said if they could win 5-1 again, that would be amazing. So that's the only connection I had to actually being there, was in the programme. So yeah, one of the most devastating games to miss, I think. And I remember I watched it in a hotel room with dodgy Wi-Fi, trying to get it on my laptop, and just sitting in a hotel room on my own watching it, and just being not much of a nervous wreck, because as soon as the goals started coming in, it was like, this is amazing, this is the best game ever. But yeah, and the trouble was as well, my cousin got married on that day as well. So if I hadn't been racing, I would have had to then potentially go to his wedding too, because I don't know if I could have got out with that by saying it was a football. I'm sure he might have understood though.
I was going to ask that next question. I was going to be, how would you have let your cousin know that you weren't going to his wedding?
I know. He lives in England though, so we could just say transport issues or something like that, I'm sure.
It's very selfish when people schedule things like weddings on cup final weekend.
I know.
In terms of your career, then, so obviously by the time 2012 it's come around, it's kind of already started. But in terms of your career as an athlete, you began as a swimmer, I think, didn't you? Before you got into running.
Yeah, my mum swam. She was quite a good swimmer, and we were all just brought up. That was the first sport I remember sort of taking quite seriously. And my sisters and brother and I were all brought up swimming, and that was the sort of sport I thought I might go and have success at. But when I started doing the athletics, that just, from what I was putting into the athletics and the success I was having, it was very different to the swimming. The swimming, I wasn't really getting the success out of it, and I was, you know, training a lot with swimming. And yeah, I just ended up enjoying the athletics more and went down that path. But I don't think, if I suck at swimming, I don't really think I would have ever done anything at it. It was, I still enjoy going to the pool now and swimming, but it's a hard sport to, I think, really be successful at.
We asked Lee McGregor a similar question when he came on, which was, when did you first know that this wasn't something you were just good at, but something that you could actually make a career of? Because, you know, you get lots of people in when they're younger, when they're at school, they play different sports. Some of them are very good. Obviously, some people are obviously not very good early on, but there's always that difference, isn't there, between being good at something and actually making a career out of it. Was it quite early on that you were made aware that this could be something you could pursue to the heights that you would end up going?
No, I think early on, you always have that dream. I also have that dream of, you know, going to the Olympics and competing for my country. But when you're young, you don't really understand what that means and what it involves and how hard it is to get there. And I think probably the first time I realised that I could do it properly as a career was probably in my early 20s, because I went to uni in Edinburgh and trained to become a teacher, a PE teacher. And then once I graduated, I did my probation year and I worked for a couple of years. And during that time, I made my first sort of GB team, got my first GB cap. And then I started to have success. And then I started to sort of save, I got on funding. And then I started to save money to then be able to leave my teaching job and go and train full time. So it was really during that period of, let's say, my early 20s when I was teaching and having that little bit of success and then trying to work out, well, actually, can I go and do this as a job? Can I financially support myself or get the support to be able to do this as a career? So yeah, I think probably a little bit later in the game than most.
How difficult is that then? Because, you know, we are a football podcast, our focus is on football, and it's very evident, obviously, when someone can, I guess, make a career out of it, because it's when they go from, I suppose, playing football at a semi-professional level to actually being paid a wage that covers it, and they're paid by a club. But it's a bit different, isn't it, with what you're looking at? You're not signing up necessarily for one club that's going to pay you X salary for a 3-4 year contract and that's it. How can you make that jump? Because yeah, like you said, you were working at Perth Grammar School as a PE teacher, weren't you? So you had that regular income.
Yeah, I mean, athletics is not really the sort of job that you make money on, and you only really start to make money once you get to a certain level. So you almost need to try and get there first before you can then have that security. So once you sort of reach a certain level, you get put on funding through the lottery, and that's all based on kind of times that you've ran and you know where you've reached. So if you're sort of a finalist at a World Championships or Olympic Games, you're on a sort of level B. If you're a medalist at an Olympic Games or World Champs, you're on level A, and that's the highest kind of rank of funding that you can get. So obviously you have to try and make it there first to get that level of funding. And then you really kind of make your money through races, and you get prize money, you get appearance money if you're at a certain level where people obviously will pay you to go and compete at their meets. And then through sponsorships, you try and negotiate yourself, or you have an agent that will try and negotiate them. So pretty much most athletes at sort of top level have their kit sponsor, but then they'll try and have other sponsors, like, you know, maybe supplements or cars or, you know, something like that. So you kind of have to sort of build your own build your own brand, almost like build your own sort of wage or income. And really, the only kind of people that make the big bucks are the ones like your Usain Bolts, you know, that are, you know they're going to be the ones that are getting the tickets sold for an event or a championship. So yeah, it's difficult. So yeah, you do have to sort of get that balance right. But I think it helps with, you know, your probably your motivation and your desire to do it, because you have to sort of get to that stage and work hard to get there. And it just means that you know you want it if you can get to that stage.
2012, obviously a big year for Hearts, but also a big year for you. Picked for the Olympics for the first time. How did that feel?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, London 2012 was a really strange one because there was a lot of pressure on the athletes, and like I say, your sort of your funding targets, your sponsorship bonuses, all those sort of things were geared around how you performed in 2012. So it was like the championships where you didn't want to miss out. You didn't want to, you know, mess up your trials, your British champs. You wanted to make sure you're on that team. And I'd been so kind of geared on making the Olympics, and my year went really well, and I got my qualifying time, got to the British champs, and secured my spot on the team. But then when I actually got to the Olympics, I hadn't really mentally prepared to be there, and I hated the whole experience. Like, I mean, you're not really meant to say that about London 2012 because everybody loved it, but for me it was like really overwhelming. It was really intimidating, and I think it was just because all the home athletes were kind of treated as stars, you know. So whether you were somebody that was like myself coming into your first Olympics with not really any massive expectations, you would walk out into that stadium, and because you were a British athlete, everybody would be screaming and shouting and watching you. And I just kind of had a bit of I wouldn't say a meltdown, but I just kind of thought, get me off this track, I don't want to be here, I don't like this attention and this pressure. So it was a really strange experience, but one that I think really, it gave me a kind of pick up the bum to say, right, well, why are you doing this? Who are you doing this for? And yeah, it was a good learning experience for me, being at that of my first Olympics.
Forrest Hepburn and MacDonald have been making creative sign and print solutions since the 1950s. For more, visit fhmcdsigns.co.uk.
Right, I'm going to talk 5-1 gestures. Scott, what's you ever get a good 5-1 gesture moment? Obviously, these days we don't do it. It's been kind of overdone. But back in the day, a 5-1 gesture was a favourite thing to wind up Hybees. And what, any particular ones that you would jump out?
Yeah, I've got a little bit of a nerdy one. So a few years ago, sort of Time Castle started getting used or sort of rented out for these sort of meet and greets with ex-wrestlers. So there's a couple of sort of different ones. There was one with Ric Flair that I went along with, one with Kurt Angle, and then there was one with Shawn Michaels. And for that one, I sort of paid a little bit extra to sort of get a sort of autograph and a photo taken, and proceeded to get a 5-1 with Shawn Michaels. Because I'm that big a nerd. I know we can't see each other, but I'm pretty sure Ryan will be shaking his head when he's hearing this.
No, I'm impressed. I love Shawn Michaels.
I got quite a good one, actually. Remember Hearts played Man City pre-season? And I was commentating on the game, and afterwards it was in the old main stand, Alvaro Negredo was there. He'd just been playing. Well, remember, he was like the beast, didn't he? They called him. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm just going to get to do a 5-1. So I did a 5-1 with him, and his English wasn't great, and he was very confused. I was like, just hold up that hand, I'll do the one. So there's this random picture of a confused-looking Man City striker doing a 5-1 with me, but we did it anyway. I mean, Ryan, one of the fingers of the five hand was thanks to you. You must have made the most of that a few times.
I still get asked to this day for 5-1 photos if I'm out and about, which is good. I think I've said it before on the podcast. I just love listening to all of these stories, you know, of people telling you where they were or why they weren't at the game or why, you know, where they traveled to get to the game. And it's still such a special feeling to know that you were sort of heavily involved in that game and to make so many people happy. But Yeah, I wouldn't mind having. Well,
if you weren't there, it would be a rubbish. It would be like a 4-1 gesture, and you'd be having to put one finger down or put your thumb down. It just wouldn't be the same, would it?
Very true. 5-1 was a good scoreline. I still get loads of people telling me that we should have got 10.
Never happy.
Honestly, I still get like loads of people being like, you know, do you not just think if you attacked a little bit more in the second half, it could have been more? Like, oh, come on, mate.
My dad's one of them. But only because he had to go through the 7-0 experience. So I think
he thought
that was the chance to get back on that. So he was actually going off his head because he was like, nah, they're giving him far too much respect. We should be going for the jugular here. And he was getting kind of frustrated in the second half, which is mental when you think of the scoreline.
Winning a cup final 5-1. Well, the reason I'm asking this, I'm sure Ailey can guess, is because I'm going to talk about the 2014 Commonwealth Games, which were very successful for you. You captained the Scottish athletics team to its best medal haul since 1990. But a very famous in heart circles photo appeared of you as well, doing a 5-1. How did that come about? Couldn't help yourself.
Yeah. Well, do you know what it was? A lot of people think, a lot of the Hibs fans think that it was planned. But actually, when I crossed the line and I was actually talking to my friend at the finish line, and there was a wee boy that had said, what a photo, and he asked me to do the 5-1, and I did it, forgetting that there'd be cameras following me around, and I'd forgotten about it, and then I did my lap of honour, and I came back and went to my phone, and my phone had just exploded, but Twitter had exploded, and it was all these people talking, showing the picture of me doing the 5-1, and it was obviously Hibs fans were going off their head at it, being how disrespectful, she just ran a race, and all the Hearts fans are obviously loving it. And I was I didn't think anybody had clocked that, but it's obviously really obvious after the race. But to be fair, I look back and I don't regret it, because I think, I'm never going to get a chance to run at Hampden again. So there's a significance of it being at Hampden where, and they were playing the Proclaimers as I was running around doing my lap of honour. So I feel like it was fair game, the fact that there was...
That's taunting you, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember going to Twitter and just being this has kicked off badly. But most of them see the funny side, but there are still Hibs fans that do not like me at all for that.
Join the club, it's fine.
How special was that then, 2014? You mentioned the 2012 Olympics. A lot of it, you didn't really enjoy that experience. 2014 Commonwealth Games, in Scotland, Hampden Park, was that a completely different experience for you?
Yeah, totally. And I think I learned from 2012 to, to really enjoy the home crowd, enjoy that support and see it for what it was. And I was, again, I was going to the Commonwealth Games in a very different position as well. I was more experienced. I was a better athlete. I was going there for a medal. It was just incredible. The whole build up to it was amazing. But I think, being able to step into the stadium and see it as an athletics track and see it full, and then to be able to do the lap of honour in that stadium was just, I think that's probably the highlight of my whole career. When I retired and I looked back on my whole career, the lap of honour, not so much the race at Hampden, because it was just, a normal race, but the lap of honour at Hampden Park, just, because there was loads of my friends and family were there. Normally when you sort of travel to races abroad or, you'll get your immediate family there, but yeah, there was just loads of people there, and I took 45 minutes to do my lap of honour. They said it was the longest lap of honour anybody did at that champs, but I was totally milking it, the whole way around. And it was amazing. Such a great couple of weeks, but just a really great experience for me.
We've talked a bit about your retirement. Obviously, it came out about around the time, shortly after you'd had your first son. Was this a tough build up? I look back at some of the things you said at the time, and I think one of the things you said, that the desire to go and compete isn't there anymore. Was that, you mentioned it was, the timing was maybe made it a bit easier, but was it a hard transition to go from knowing that you are an athlete and you're competing in that sense to not? Or was it the blow softened because of the other circumstances?
Yeah, I think it was softened just with, like I say, with everything that was going on, with the fact that, you know, competition at that time was very different. You know, so I looked at the Tokyo Olympics, and the plan was to try and make those Olympics. But I remember we had these kind of meetings well in advance about sort of planning and preparation of going out there, and it was a case of you'll be out there for sort of 6 weeks, and you'll need to make sure you test every morning, and then, you know, if you test positive for COVID, you're going to be put in isolation, and all that kind of rigmarole that goes into it. And I think had I been in my early 20s, you know, didn't have any family, it'd be a case of, yep, we'll just go out there, we do everything we need to do to make sure I'm ready for the Olympics. But at that point, you know, like I say, I had a wee boy who was, you know, just over a year, and the thought of potentially being away from him for that amount of time, and maybe longer if I tested positive, just didn't appeal to me at all. And before COVID hit, my plan was, so my husband was my coach for the latter part of my career. So we'd planned before, obviously, COVID and everything, that when we go out to Tokyo, my husband will come with me and he'll bring my wee boy, and it'll be this family unit, and we'll go out there and we'll be a unit, and that's it. So when it all changed and then it was going to be a case of me going out there myself, it was like, but it's not just about me. We've got our team, and our team was meant to be going out there. So yeah, there was loads of elements like that. And again, it just made the decision easier. You know, it just made it the only decision really that I could have made, I think.
One thing I found quite interesting, I've spoken to a few people about this, and I was speaking to a former footballer not that long ago about this, and he said one of the things that is quite hard, and he mentioned he thinks that's why certain, not just footballers, but athletes maybe sometimes, you know, maybe go get into gambling or drink too much, is that it's hard to maybe find something that matches the high you get from playing. Obviously, when he was talking about it, it's, you know, it's winning a football game or it's scoring a goal. Is that something that maybe you find that it's hard to kind of replicate, or you miss that, the moment of obviously racing and crossing the finish line, winning a medal?
Yeah, I don't think anything beats that, you know, and like I say, the lapse of honour, you know, especially that one in Glasgow, nothing else will beat that. But then you sort of counterbalance it with the training and the time away. And yes, that moment is why you do all the hard work, you do all the training, but that moment is over so quickly. And so it's trying to savour that as much as you can. I think what it is as well is, I think for a lot of sports people, and it's and anybody really, it's having that balance in your life as well. So it's, yes, I was an athlete and that was my, you know, what I did, but there was also loads of other elements to who I am as a person. And I think I had quite a nice balance with, you know, family life, other things going on, that when I did stop my athletics, it wasn't like, oh, what do I do now? That's me. I'm no longer an athlete anymore. I managed to sort of have other things kind of going on. I mean, I was on the board. I'm on the board of Scottish Athletics. I did work for Sport Scotland. So I still had those connections to sport as well, which I think is really important. Because I think sometimes when you do retire as well, it's like you feel like, well, that's it, I'm cut off completely. And you do, you will get that with certain people in the sport, you know, the performance coaches, those guys that they're there with you when they want you, you know, to win the medals, because all of a sudden when you retire, right, you're not winning medals anymore, so we don't need you anymore. And I always kind of understood that relationship. But I think, again, if you don't understand that relationship you have with these people, that can sometimes be quite difficult as well, because you feel a bit like, oh, I'm a bit worthless now. I'm not any use to anybody anymore. So there's loads to it. There's loads of different elements to it. But like I say, it was fairly straightforward for me.
Will you miss the training, Ryan?
No, I won't miss the training. I'll miss the games and the big games, but I don't think I'll miss training. But it's similar. As you get older, you have kids, you know, that's why, like, people, especially myself, like, respect those athletes that do it for such a long period of time. You know, talking top level, Ronaldo, Messi, LeBron James, those people, the drive that they have to, like, continually do what they do at such a high level, you know, for 20, 30 years almost, is incredible. I will not miss football, I think, as much as I possibly would have when I was younger. That's for sure.
Post-retirement, Ailey, you've mentioned some of the things you're involved in, but when we take it back to Hearts a little bit, Your name came up just later last year, so it was only a few months back, actually, in terms of the work that the Foundation of Hearts does. I know you were brought in as part of a marketing group. It was mentioned by Jerry Mallon in one of the Foundation of Hearts updates, and I think you've been involved in some of the recent projects. So how did that come about, and what sort of things have you been doing with the Foundation?
Yeah, well, it all started really, I was invited to one of the plot ceremonies, not my own one, just to go in and talk. And yeah, just got chatting to the guys there. And it was Alistair, one of the guys involved, and he said to me, would you like to be involved a bit more? And I was like, yeah, that sounds really good. So they kind of brought me in, and really, to begin with, it was me just kind of listening. I mean, I've got no marketing background whatsoever, so it was more me just listening and kind of getting an idea of what they do. But the main project I've kind of been brought in to help with is the Maroon Mile. So obviously this is going to be the mile that's set up, and part of what we're wanting to do is do like an annual event, which is either walk the mile, run the mile, where we get sort of members of the foundation to take part, hopefully get players involved as well, and make it this kind of annual event where everybody gets together, make it a bit of a competition as well. We've sort of been looking at potentially having players have teams, so you know you get allocated to one of the players and you're part of that team. And it's, yeah, just about kind of, again, bringing everybody together just to celebrate the foundation, but also just celebrate being Hearts fans. I think that's one of the big things that I took from, you know, being a youngster, going to games with my dad, the sort of family side, the community side of being a Hearts fan. It's so much there, you know. So yeah, this is one of the projects I've kind of been brought into, because although I don't understand marketing, I understand running and events like that, and hopefully this will be something that, yeah, we can put a bit of a stamp down on.
You think it's a good thing, Scott, that the foundation are clearly expanding and broadening horizons a little bit and helping promote Hearts, engaging with the likes of Alien. I know there's a few others who've been involved as well.
Yeah, I think it was probably required at some stage. I think it was, you're always susceptible to creating a bit of an echo chamber if there's maybe only four or five individuals having the same sort of monthly interactions, and you know, if all the individuals all come from a similar background, that can sometimes not help as well. So I think getting additional volunteers and definitely helps. And the Maroon Mile sounds like a great idea. I mean, we're quite fortunate, you know, if you see the number of sort of English top flight teams, some teams in Scotland even, that they sort of relocate their stadiums, and they really don't have any kind of connection with the local community, where, you know, you can see from Haymarket all the way along, and then Gorgie Road as well. There's a lot of sort of like landmarks, is maybe too strong a word, but something like that, you know. I was just thinking the Gorgie Fish Bar is not a landmark. What are you talking about? but you know, to local people,
Tiny Arms.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's home comforts, isn't it? And I think bringing something in that'll tie in with these types of places will be good. And I think it's a really good idea. It was great when I first heard of it a few weeks ago.
In terms of sticking with Hearts, but looking at the women's team, I noticed, Ailey, you were involved in one of the Scottish Cup draws later last year for the early rounds of this competition, or it was maybe the round in January, actually. Hearts women into the semi-finals, which is good to see. How did you get involved in that, and how impressed have you been at the progress of the Hearts women's side in the last few years?
Yeah, well, I was asked, it was actually via Heart. I did a piece with Lewis Irons, so it was based around Hearts being in the cup final back in, well, it must have been 2022.
We're in them all the time these days, so it's just need to start winning.
Well, I know, that's it. So he said to me, oh, have you ever done the Scottish Cup draw? And I said no. And he said, would you like to do it? And I said, not really, no, because I'd be terrified that I would, you know, draw Hearts against Rangers, or like, you know, really muck it up. And so he'd said to me, well, have a think about it, and if you change your mind, let me know. But then he actually got in contact with me and put me in touch with one of his colleagues who'd said, would you like to do the women's draw? And I said yes. I felt a bit safer. I thought, doesn't it feel as pressurized as the men side of things. So I got involved in that way and went along and did that. But I keep an eye. I do follow women's football quite a lot. I've got a niece who'll be 10 this year who loves football, and I just think it's nice for her that she can actually grow up watching it and playing it if she wants to as well. There's routes there now and choices there for her. So I think it's really great how much it's coming on.
Right, so you're retired now. You did stay down in England for a period back when you were competing. You're back up fairly local to Edinburgh. Do you manage to get to a few more games these days than when you were an active athlete, or does mother duties still get in the way a bit now?
They do a little bit. My mum and dad and my brother are all season ticket holders, so when they don't make a game, I tend to take one of their tickets. And sometimes I feel like a bit, you know, you feel like a bit of a fraud when you sometimes get hospitality as well. Sometimes if I want to go to a game, I'll play that card and I'll maybe just be like, contact Dan Park and just say, can I maybe just come along to a game? I'm home, you know, I'm around. So, but I feel like you're not really a true fan if you do that. You're kind of cheating a little bit. So I'm actually going to...
I'll wait for that one.
I'm actually going to the it was my dad's 70th at the start of the year, so part of his 70th present, we got him hospitality. So it's actually the Kilmarnock game on the 30th of March, I think it is. So I'm going to go with him to that sort. I'll try and get here and there. I think I can't quite sell it to my husband yet that I can go every weekend. My husband's not a football fan at all, so I'm able to wait till my boys are a bit older, and then we can go as a family.
I'm disappointed. I was hoping he was a Hearts fan, because I was thinking then you've got the kind of Sporting Edinburgh families. You've got the Doyles and the Boyles, because you've got Martin Boyle and Rachel Boyle over at Hibs, and you could have
Alien. No, he's from Glasgow, so his family are all Celtic fans, unfortunately. But he didn't support anybody.
Can't have everything, can you?
No, but my sons will be. They'll be getting heart strips.
That's good, because not everyone's children end up following the right team, do they?
I've Scott, told you. Ryan. I've told you. They'll grow out of it. It's just a little phase. Praying it's a little phase.
I don't know if... I don't think Scott... I think Scott's given up on him.
No, I've got less confidence that this is going to be a phase for Brandon. I think he's well indoctrinated now into the Hibs way.
Ellie, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for taking the time to come on and chat about us. Before you go, I know you've been involved in a few different things you mentioned already, but we can also hear you on another podcast, can't we, just now?
Yeah, so myself and Susan Egglestaff, Susan's a former badminton player, former Olympian, who now writes, is a sports journalist, now writes for the Herald. We've been doing a podcast, mainly sort of looking at Scottish athletes, but we've now started a new series, which is going to be looking back. It's the 10-year anniversary of Glasgow 2014, so we're going to be interviewing athletes, volunteers, coaches, officials that were involved in Glasgow 2014, and sort of go back and, you know, talk about how it was for them, and also kind of what's happened for them in the last 10 years. So actually, our first one comes out this week, and it's Ross Murdoch, who was a swimmer who... won gold on the very first night of the games. Massive surprise. He beat Michael Jameson, who was the sort of poster boy of the games. So we've got him talking first, and it's a really, really interesting interview. Talks about all the things right about the games, but also speaks a little bit about imposter syndrome and the sort of effect that the games had on him, because he was only 20 when he won that gold medal. So yeah, and we've recorded quite a few now, so we've got a few good guests coming up. So yeah, it's called The Inside Track, and you can get it on all the sort of podcast stations, Spotify, Apple Podcasts and things like that. So, yeah, tune in.
Check it out. Yeah, The Inside Track on all your usual podcast sources, as Ellie says. In terms of Hearts, what are you hoping for this season? You think I can go on and win the Cup?
I mean, I think that would be amazing, wouldn't it? I think I'll just top off what's been, you know, a pretty good season, you know, and I think it's maintaining that consistency, isn't it? You know, those really great performances that we've seen, those big performances that we've seen. I do feel positive about it. I do feel like there's, you know, there is a special spark this year. So, it'd be amazing. It would be amazing if we go on and win the Cup. I think that would just really just, you know, tick all the boxes.
And we'd be back at Hampden to watch it if Hearts are there come May, 10 years after one of your favourite moments at Hampden.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be so fitting, wouldn't it? Yeah, that would be amazing. So, yes, we'll definitely make sure I'll be at that one.
Well, hopefully we're all at Hampden in May. Right, Ryan will be there as well. I'm sure he'll find a way. He'll pull some strings and get hospitality.
Someone would need to get me a ticket.
They'll have to. I mean, it's kind of obliged at this point, aren't we?
Yeah, need to.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Ailey. So good luck with everything. We'll share the details of that podcast as well. And yeah, keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ailey. You're listening to Scarves Around the Funnel, sponsored by Forest Hepburn and McDonald's Signs, who have been offering creative sign and print solutions since the 1950s. Big thanks to Ailey Doyle for joining us for a chat on this week's episode. Hopefully, Ryan, maybe put you a bit more at ease with the whole retirement thing coming up.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate your support.
We're here for you.
I know.
Don't worry about it. International weekend coming up. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. What are we doing, guys? We're making the most of nothing happening. A few days off. Ryan, Scott, you doing something at the weekend?
I've not got any plans yet.
Scotland, Netherlands, Friday night.
Yeah.
Aussie got a big couple of games. You know, watch those, Ryan?
They do have games. I probably will not watch them, but they do have games. I'm not sure who against.
Lebanon. Jesus.
Lebanon.
You don't support them
home? I know it's at home.
I know you don't get to warm the bench for them anymore, but I thought you'd at least know who they're playing.
Played against. No, I didn't. I went to Lebanon. I didn't play in the game. As a surprise to no one. But yes, went to Beirut for a game of football. I think we got beat, actually. But no, just quiet. We've got the weekend off. So we're in all week and then have the weekend off and then it's a normal week. We got a big game against Dundee when we come back. So it's a big, the old six-pointer.
Yeah, six-pointer for us. Aberdeen, Ross County as well. So it's a big weekend coming up for you guys and the bottom few places in the league. Well, we obviously don't have a game to preview. Big Gordon, Xander Clark, Lawrence Shankland will be away with Scotland. We think they'll all get some action, Scott.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. I'm hoping that Shankland, especially, I think the Northern Ireland game's the one. I think Mark said this last week. That's the one you really want to give him a chance in because you expect him to maybe get a little bit more of the ball. I just feel like against the Netherlands, it's probably more primed to having somebody like a Shea Adams or a Lyndon Dyke sort of running the channels and, you know, linking the play. So I'm hopefully seeing him probably more so against Ireland than the Netherlands. And I think Xander Clark will probably get a half of football as well, I would imagine.
You got Macaulay Tate in the 19s for Scotland, Aaron Denham in the 21s. Elsewhere, I mentioned Australia, Kai Rolls and Nathaniel Atkinson will be included in their squad for the back-to-back qualifiers against Lebanon. Kenneth Vargas is in the squad for Costa Rica, who face Honduras in the CONCACAF Nations League tie, and then Argentina in a friendly, and Dexter Lembakisa called up by Jamaica for their CONCACAF Nations League tie against the USA. A lot of travelling there. Does that take its toll, Ryan? Haven't done that before.
Yeah, it can do. The Aussie boys will be used to it, and they obviously have to go the furthest, so they're probably the better ones, you know, the boys that have just been sort of called in. Sometimes that can take a little bit of a toll on your body, but it also sometimes depends on what game you're involved in. You know, if you play both games, it doesn't matter where you play. It's, you know, it's a lot of football to have played, but if you can kind of maybe sometimes, I know a lot of coaches prefer if they play the sort of first one, so they get that, you know, there's not much training that goes on in between those games. So I think if a lot of the sort of managers prefer if their players play in that first game, and then they can kind of chill out and get back. But 9 times out of 10, you're kind of back on the, going to guess that the Aussie boys are maybe back on the Wednesday or the Thursday morning. So yeah, the good thing is that the boys that have to travel the furthest, they're used to that in terms of the Aussie boys. And like what Scott mentioned, sometimes it's good for the other ones to get away from sort of club football and be able to sort of take their mind off it while getting that recognition of what they're doing at the club is doing them well for the international scene.
I should mention as well, Toby Sibbick is away with Uganda as well. They've got a couple of friendly games. So lots of players away. I'm sure Cammy Devlin has asked Vargas to say hello to his good pal Leo Messi when he faces Argentina. Maybe if he's even given some tips about how to go about trying to get yourself a Messi shirt post-game. Hopefully everyone comes back fighting fit and they are ready to go for that game against Kilmarnock, which we will preview next week. We'll have a talk about how the players have all done on international duty and anything else that comes up. If you want to get in touch in the meantime, you can tweet at Around the Funnel or you can email podcast@scarvesaroundthefunnel.co.uk. Till next time, thanks for tuning in.